I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times. Amira Tucker is a 25-year-old African-American woman living in Philadelphia after graduating from Temple University. She works part-time for a wealthy white couple, Alex and Peter Chamberlain, taking care of their toddler, Briar, with whom she has a close and loving relationship. One night at a neighborhood market, Amira is racially profiled and accused by the store guard of kidnapping Briar. This incident is how Kylie Reed begins her debut novel, Such a Fun Age. It explores and reveals the fraught intersection of race and class and the unspoken subtleties of prejudice. The book was just published, and already a production company has acquired rights to it. Kylie Reed lives in Philadelphia. She earned an MFA from the Iowa Writers Workshop, where she was awarded the Truman Capote Fellowship, and she joins us on Radio Times. And congratulations on your book. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you. So happy to be here.
So happy to have you. I'd love to have you read from the beginning of the book.
It's very late for someone this small, he said. Is this your child? No, Amira laughed. I'm her babysitter. All right, well, he said, with all due respect, you don't look like you've been babysitting tonight. Amira found herself arranging her mouth as if she'd ingested something too hot. She caught a morphed reflection in a freezer door, and she saw herself in her entirety. Her face, full brown lips, a tiny nose, and a high forehead covered with black bangs barely showed up in the reflection. Her black skirt, her slinky V-neck top, and her liquid eyeliner refused to take shape in the panels of thick glass. All she could see was something very dark and skinny and the top of a small, blonde stick of hair that belonged to Briar Chamberlain. "Kay," she exhaled. "I'm her babysitter, and her mom called me because... Hi, I'm so sorry. I just... Hi." From the other end of the aisle, the woman came forward, and her very used tennis shoes squeaked against the tile floor. She put a hand to her chest. "I'm a mom, and I heard the little girl say that she's not with her mom, and since it's so late, I got a little nervous." Amira looked at the woman and half laughed. The sentiment felt childish, but all she could think was, "You really just told on me right now?"
That's the beginning, or near beginning, of Kylie Reed's new novel, Such a Fun Age. It's a very strong place to begin. Why did you want to start there?
I love when a book hooks me in the beginning, and I kind of like watching the fallout from an event that joins people that they can't get rid of. It's kind of this invisible connector that they have to wrestle with. And as a reader, sometimes I can be a bit impatient, and I just need a little something at the beginning.
So let's just get the story started.
Yeah,
here.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, it's such an interesting time to be telling a story like this. And I was actually thinking of what happened in Starbucks in Philadelphia a couple of years ago, where two black men went in. They wanted to use the bathroom, as many people do in Starbucks, and ended up getting arrested.
These
I won't call them small because they're not small, but these moments of racial misunderstanding or racial prejudice.
Absolutely. It's funny you say that because the book went on submission the week that that happened.
Really?
And so it's, you know, for the book's sake, you know, a relevant thing, and that's wonderful. And on the same time, it's terrible that these are happening every day. And I wanted to, like, as a person, I'm really interested in the bigger socioeconomic causes of these things. But as a writer, I'm really intrigued by the tiny domestic instances like these that seem really small because they're not violent, but they're traumatizing. You can't leave that. And I don't think it's just traumatizing for the person that it happened to. I think for people watching, everyone involved, it's this fallout that you can't get rid of very easily.
Amira's at this supermarket. She happens to be with Briar for reasons that are maybe a little too complicated to go into. But nonetheless, Briar's parents said, "Would you take her out just for a bit so we can deal with something at home?" Which she does. And she's with a friend, and they're having fun, and they're goofing off, and they're being, you know, young women having fun with this little girl.
Right.
And then, boom, it changes.
Exactly. Yeah. And when I first started writing it, I had a character who was a bit outlandish saying, "You stole that child. What's going on? This isn't okay." And the more I wrote and the more I asked friends for advice, I really thought about how insidious it is when someone is concerned and still racially biased and saying, "Hey, I'm a little bit nervous. I'm a mom. I just want to make sure this is okay." And in this instance, it results in, you know, accusing her of kidnapping. But in other instances, it's, you know, oh, I want my kids to go to a safe school, or this restaurant seemed sketchy, or I just wanted to be safe. And I think that that's more commonly how racial bias shows itself, is in safety and precaution.
Well, Amira says to herself, you really just told on me right now?
Right.
I mean, the idea is everything just changed at that moment.
Totally. And I think the whole thing seems a bit absurd and silly to Amira. And I think that's how these events happen. And I really wanted to luxuriate in the period before this is an event where everyone involved is saying, wait a second, do I pull out my phone? Is this an instance right now? Am I going to be a hashtag right now? Like, what is my safety in this moment?
You have said in other interviews that you're interested in these awkward moments. I mean, these moments where I guess things are not resolved. What interests you about that?
I love a little bit of a glitch in the system when it comes to etiquette and manners, particularly when a tiny moment will bring back an entire history of prejudice and slavery and labor laws not being given to a majority of Black and brown people. As a reader, I love when things make me crawl out of my skin a little bit, particularly when they're tiny, because I think it's very human. Those tiny little instances where you think you said something wrong, those are the ones that keep you up at night. And so that's definitely the ones I like to write about.
Tell us about Amira. She's a very specific age. She's in her mid-20s.
She is. Amira is 25. She took 5 years to graduate from college, as I did, so I understand.
I took six, just
there
so you
go.
Know.
That okay. Victory lap is important, yes.
She made it through.
Yeah. She is at this place where her college job has said, hey, we need to keep entry-level jobs open to entry-level people. She doesn't know what she wants to do. She loves babysitting, and she's good at it. She's coming at the end of her parents' health insurance, and she's learning as her friends start making more money and as she starts navigating what her life is going to look like, that her financial situation is not available to continue these things. So she's at a very financially precarious place, but she also doesn't have a passion. She's very naturally rejecting careerism. She's not just going to jump into anything because she just needs it. But she's also sick of making the same crock pot meal four nights a week. And she's looking for her life to look like her friends a little bit.
Well, that gets me to your title, Such a Fun Age. I think whoever the collective we is, we think, oh, you're 20s, you're starting your careers or your job or relationships or whatever, thinking, oh, this is such an exciting time. But for Amira, it's fraught in many ways.
It's very fraught. She is not at the place that she thought she would be. And I think it's so fascinating to look at where we require people to be right after college, especially when you start college. I think it's crazy. You're 18, pick a major and do that for the rest of your life. That's crazy. That's not how my life went. And I ended up okay. There are people who don't have the benefits that I do, like Amira, who this is that in-between period where she's figuring out what that means.
Well, you worked as a babysitter.
I did.
And a nanny.
Mm-hmm.
And you've had multiple jobs.
I've had way too many jobs.
I don't think it's possible to have too many jobs.
I mean, they all feed into the novel. You're right. So, right. Yeah.
And were you, I mean, she's a terrific babysitter. And she loves Briar. Mm-hmm. And she's totally connected to this child. Were you a good babysitter?
I was a very good babysitter, probably because I think I have, it's funny, I have a bit of Alex's nervous energy, so I was very concerned with doing the right thing all the time. But I also love children, and I think that they're really funny and honest, and so there were many children who I felt really connected to.
Let's talk a bit about Alex.
Yeah.
And it's Alex and Peter Chamberlain.
Mm-hmm.
So Amira works for them, but largely works for Alex.
Right.
I mean, that's sort of the way things happen in this family. Help us understand Alex, and she's complicated.
Alex is very
challenging
complicated.
Character, I have to say.
She is. She is an entrepreneur. She has a small business that has a feminist brand and is about taking it back to basics and really asking for what you want. Alex came from Allentown, Pennsylvania, and she lived in New York for a number of years, and I think that's where she really found herself. She's left New York for a family move for her husband's job, and now she's very lonely without her group of girlfriends and all of her regular haunts, and she's figuring out who she is. Alex is one of those characters that really fascinates me because she finds herself in a position of power that she doesn't really know what to do with. She's had interns before. She, you know, has hired people in the past, but suddenly this event highlights the fact that she's hiring an African-American woman who comes in contact with racial bias when she's taking care of her child. And I think that really rocks her, and she doesn't know how to handle it.
And here they are. I mean, I think it's often true with that nanny slash babysitting relationship with the employer, and they mm-hmm. are the employer, and yet you're sharing a house. You're probably sharing a kitchen. I mean, there's so much intimacy in that relationship, and yet it is employer-employee.
Right, right. I think,
and she calls her Mrs. Chamberlain, too, which I thought was interesting.
She does. I'm very interested in the boundaries people set up with language to protect themselves or keep a certain relationship how it is. But I think Alex is one of the many people who says, we are hiring this person to work with our family, so what's the best thing we can do for her? Let's make her part of the family. But when you make someone a part of the family, you deny yourself the role as employer. I would never give my husband sick days or, you know, give him a 2 weeks notice or pay him a bonus. You wouldn't do that because you're family. But when you're an employee, you need your employer to protect you with those things. So it's a really precarious space they're in.
And not to give too much away, but Alex, I mean, I would say she is liberal.
She is, yeah.
I mean, she would define herself as liberal. And yet, as this story unfolds, almost feels as if she's treating Amira like a trophy, or like, this is my black friend, mm-hmm. you know?
It's funny because...
And sort of introducing the world, saying, look, see, I have a black friend.
She's very intrigued by Amira, and she Amira's music taste and her clothes and her perfume just seems so other to her that she's very fascinated. And I don't think Alex has a problem being friends with black people. One of her best friends is black, but the fact that Amira is a low-income woman who texts things to her friends that she would never text. She's so intrigued that she develops a bit of a crush on her. And that mixed with her loneliness on top of, you know, work's hold on her. She really feels like she needs to get back to work. And I think Amira just becomes a bit of a distraction that goes too far.
I just scribbled the word crush, but also obsession, maybe?
A little bit. I mean, I've been in that position where I become really fascinated with maybe an album or a book, but for Alex, it's someone that she employs, and she doesn't really respect that relationship all the time. Yeah.
The title of your book is Such a Fun Age, and I was saying to you before going mm-hmm. on the air, there's so many ways to say that
there
title.
Is.
How do you say it?
Oh, well, I always say it straight away because I don't want to have any inflection or let anyone in on anything. I say such a fun age. When I was a nanny, the way that it was always said was, oh, 18 months, that's such a fun age all the time. But I also remember in the hardships of being 22, 23, I didn't have health insurance for a number of years. And I was like, geez, it's such a fun age. Okay, like this is really difficult. Mm-hmm. So I love the play on that. And especially this is a book based in 2015, before our current presidency. And I think that time, it can be romanticized by a few, but it's important to look at, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement coming out of it. So there's a lot of meanings here.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with Kylie Reed. She's got a new novel. In fact, it's her debut novel called Such a Fun Age. It's already been acquired. A production company has already acquired the rights to it, so it could be on a screen somewhere in the future. Kylie Reed lives in Philadelphia. She got an MFA from the Iowa Writers Workshop. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Kylie Reed about her debut novel, Such a Fun Age, about race, wealth, class, and babysitting. It's gotten a lot of attention. It's about a young woman named Amira Tucker, and she is a babysitter for a wealthy white couple. They live in Philadelphia, and an incident at a supermarket or a local market leads to a whole host of interesting intersections and thoughts about prejudice and race and class. The husband's name is Peter Chamberlain. He's a local TV anchor.
He is.
There's a segment on the air, and it's about interracial dating, or I guess it's about dating in high school.
Yeah, it's about really a little bit cheesy, but very sweet ways that students at a high school ask each other to prom.
And what does he say on the air?
When the last student asks a girl to prom by dancing with his friends, it's an African-American student, and they go back to Peter, and Peter says, "Oh, man, I hope that last one asked her father first." And that causes a bit of a stir.
And he says this on the air.
He says it on the air, yes. And so that's the inciting event for what kicks off the novel, with students being really upset by him saying this and throwing eggs at their house.
And again, it's one of those offhand comments that is so loaded.
It's so loaded, especially because he didn't say that about anyone else. And Peter and his wife consider themselves very liberal people, from how they raise their children to who they want around their children to who they vote for. But it's this little comment that sneaks out, and it's one of those glitches in the system that kind of reveals where his heart is at.
You wanted to explore in this book, it sounds like, where all these intersections, whether race, class, prejudice, also employment, labor, emotional labor, which in many ways is what babysitting or being a nanny is about, is being a loving companion and support for a young child.
Absolutely. It's strange because babysitting is a thing that we do since we're 10 years old often, and it's been kept as a low status position for a number of reasons. At the same time, you have to be on all the time. Your margin of error is so small. I remember when I was a receptionist, if I messed up a call, I would say, okay, I'll do it better next time. But when I was a nanny, I remember thinking, oh my gosh, if this kid had fallen, if something had happened, that would ruin everything for me, for the family, for the child. And still, with this high, you know, stakes situation, you're paid, if you're lucky, $16 an hour. And on top of that, you can't help but fall in love with the child a little bit and develop this relationship. But any relationship that can only happen with an exchange of goods has a layer between. And so I wanted to explore all of those things and really give every character room to be frustrated with the parents, to fall in love with the child, to not make great decisions sometimes, and still be really good at their job.
In your novel, Amira grows up in this little town called Sewell Bridge, and you write here, where 6.5% of the population of 5,850 people are hearing impaired. Mm-hmm. And I circled that because I thought, what an interesting little tidbit that
is. No one's asked me about that yet, so
I'm
happy.
I'm glad. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I'm very interested in jobs where you're working with your hands. And through writing this novel, I had many of those jobs, from being a barista to a waitress to working at Godiva Chocolate for a long time. And I came across a documentary called The Sound and the Fury, which is very interesting and covers a family in a town in Maryland that has a high deaf population, where most people work with their hands. And so I thought that was an interesting place for Amira to come from, especially that since she is a bit aimless and feels, I think I write, that her hands haven't found themselves yet. Mm. I was very inspired by that.
You also reference at the very end in the acknowledgments a book written by Rachel Sherman. It's called Uneasy Street, Anxieties of Affluence.
Yes.
As you say, this is really was one of the drivers for this story.
It was a huge source of inspiration. I felt that by the time that I read it, I think it was 3 years ago, I had the plot of my novel done, and I knew what the what was, but I didn't really know the why yet. And so reading that book was a big game changer. It's fascinating, and Rachel Sherman is a sociologist at the New School who interviewed many families, very wealthy in New York City, about their wealth, about their deservingness of their wealth. It's a very awkward, honest book. And the way that these families would normalize their lives, would justify their wealth, and all of the mental gymnastics that they would use, I was so inspired by it, especially when it comes to dialogue, because there's a lot of dialogue.
There is a lot of dialogue
in my novel. I thought it was fascinating how answers like, you know, oh, no, we're normal. We don't have like a gazillion dollars. We go to bed and we put our pajamas on just like everyone else. And I think saying that you go to bed and put your pajamas on and as a way to normalize who you are is so fascinating. And when you zoom out, it shows people equating their wealth with their goodness, which I think is so fascinating too.
Well, it's called Anxieties of Affluence,
exactly.
Right? Sort of trying to figure out how to navigate, I guess, what affluence gives a person.
Absolutely. I think my favorite part of the novel, the book Uneasy Street, is the zoom out too. You know, as soon as you're judging the goodness of very rich people, you're not judging the systems that allow this extreme wealth disparity. And that runs through the book, which is fantastic.
Well, it's interesting because these are complicated characters. And, you know, I struggled with Alex just because of her privilege and a kind of cluelessness, but also her loneliness as she's trying to find her way. And she does try to connect with Amira, saying, I also buy shoes at Payless. And I also, as you were saying, I also put on my pajamas.
Totally. I think the way that people try to level themselves is so fascinating and often like does a lot more harm than good. And I've definitely been on the receiving end of that, where someone says like, oh, you know, me too. And I love a cheap buy. And I think it's so interesting to say, like, what are you trying to do by this? And how is it making you like kind of put little money in your goodness meter a little bit? Yeah, I think it's interesting.
But it is, I think, an awkward way of trying to connect. Right?
Oh, totally. Yeah, there's things that Alex does to Amira, like buying her a salad and saying, oh, I just got this, or giving her a bottle of wine. And these are all nice gestures that we would do for friends, but Alex would never do those to her friends, the African-American ones included. And so it's a little bit cringy watching Alex try to connect with Amira.
I mean, we have a hard enough time talking about race. I don't know if class is any harder, but, you know, certainly equally as fraught, but raising, I think, different personal issues.
Oh, for sure. I think separating the two makes it a moot point. I think they have to be included together. And the songs Amira listens to how she speaks when she's with her friends versus when she's at work, all of those just really draw Alex in a way that unfortunately becomes a bit unhealthy.
This is a dialogue-driven story. There's a lot of talking in this novel.
Yes.
Girlfriends talking to each other.
Yeah, yeah. I think that, I went to school for theater and I love dialogue a lot. I think it's super revealing. And I love dialogue that sounds and looks exactly the way that it's heard. And I wanted to accomplish that in a number of ways. I think for Black people, code switching is a huge part of their lives. And I wanted to give Amira and her girlfriends freedom to be really silly with one another and speak the way they wanted, and then turn on that corporate dialogue when they feel like they need to.
And she's got a lot of girlfriends.
She does.
A real core group of friends.
Yeah, they're wonderful and loyal and also give terrible advice sometimes, like many girlfriends do. Yeah.
Do you have a similar?
I do. I have a group text of girlfriends who work very much the same way. Yes.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Kylie Reed, our guest on Radio Times for this portion of the show. She's a brand new novelist. She's got a debut novel just out called Such a Fun Age. You can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You grew up in Tucson, Arizona.
I did, yes. It's a beautiful place. It's really hot. I just got married there in March. It's beautiful.
And it is really hot. I mean, what, 100 and some degrees in the summer?
Mm-hmm. I remember that I originally lived in Los Angeles, and the day that we moved to Tucson, I was 7 years old, and it was 117 degrees. And I thought, this will not do. But I lived there for a very long time.
Yeah. So what drew your family to Tucson?
I think it was my father's job that we went there for. But yeah, Tucson's wonderful. Spent a lot of time reading indoors. But yeah, it's great.
Good old air conditioning.
Yeah.
When did you start writing, or when did you start thinking that you would like to be a writer? You could be a writer.
Yeah, I was writing from a very early age. I remember 6 and 7 filling up notebooks, but I never saw writing as a profession that could keep me employed. And so when I was in my early 20s, I realized that this is what I wanted to do. And I thought the way to be a writer was to find a really stable job that I could write in the off times. And so I also needed health insurance like Amira. And so I got a job as a receptionist. And that's where I started writing very often in the evenings and at my lunch breaks.
A receptionist for what kind of?
A design firm called IDEO in New York City. So I was there for 3 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Fielding phone calls and connecting people and welcoming them to the firm.
Oh, yes. 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 Lots of voice changing going up and down as I navigate my day. But yeah, I actually made really good friends there. So it makes me happy.
And what's been your reaction to all this publicity, attention, reviews?
It's fairly
wild. Have gotten in the last week or two.
The goal was always to write a novel that people can connect with, but also that can set me up to do it again and hopefully teach. I love teaching, and so I would love to go back to that. The excitement is really overwhelming, but wonderful. And I remember as I was choosing which editor I wanted to work with, the Putnam, who I ended up going with, just really geeked out over the story and were just so excited about something that was separate from me, and that felt really great. And so it's really exciting to see people freak out over a woman and her babysitter. So, yeah, it's been really touching.
But I'm imagining, you know, here you are working as a receptionist and writing at night. I mean, just trying to imagine what that those kinds of accolades and attention would mean.
I mean, I don't think I've wrapped around my head around it yet. But I will say, as I start writing another novel, having the space and time to do ample research makes me so nervously excited for what I get to do next. So I probably should just sit in the moment, but I'm thinking to the future a little bit. Yeah.
And what did you learn at the Iowa Writers Workshop? I mean, I know that's sort of a premier place to go.
I had a great experience, especially with this novel. I was in the novel workshop with Paul Harding, who was so fantastic. And especially with this novel, I got to explore my interest in how memory works and how, as an author, you deploy how those things work. Especially with a few characters in the novel who have a history together, it happened 15 years ago. So I had a teacher who really inspired me to treat the memory as if it's 15 years ago, which means that I don't have to tell the reader exactly how it happened. Huh. The only thing I have to tell them is how these two people saw it. And that is layered with their own insecurities and jealousies and self-satisfaction. And so the reader doesn't really know exactly how these things went down, but I want it to be as realistic to life as you can. And that's how memory works sometimes.
Amira has a boyfriend. In fact, he's at this market when this incident happens. And there's a scene on a train where they're pretending to be girlfriend or boyfriend, or maybe he's more pretending than she is.
Yes.
And it's fun. It's cute. It's flirty.
Right. I mean, I love a good meet cute. I mean,
it's very meet cute.
Yes. I wanted Kelly to be really charming at his best. And I wanted us to get to watch Amira figure out, is this someone I can date? Do I want to date him? Is this just a fun one-night thing? Amira's 25. She's not trying to meet her soulmate yet. And so I wanted to keep her attitude towards him really ambivalent and true to 25-year-old experience.
One of Amira's friends says about him, his name is Kelly, he's like the one white guy at every black wedding who's like super hyped to do the Cupid shuffle.
He is. I've met many of them. Kelly has a lot of black friends. He's into hip hop, and that's been his life for a long time. And I wanted to really dance the line between, okay, is this fetishizing someone or is this a really genuine feeling? And I wanted to do that for two reasons. One, I think it just makes for a really interesting character. But two, I think that's how people work a lot of the time. I remember in college, I knew so many girls who would pretend to be interested in rap and hip hop, but then they would find songs that they genuinely liked. And I think that that's how we are. We're complicated. And so I wanted to give him room to do that.
Well, it's an interesting interracial relationship that,
right.
they have.
Yeah.
That as a reader, we explore, again, those sort of missed moments or misunderstandings and the connection as well.
Yeah. Yeah. She's at this place where she says, do I want to bring that up now or is that going to ruin everything? And okay, I'm going to let this pass for right now. And I hope that the reader is kind of with her in that and saying, wait, is this a good guy? I can't tell. I don't know. He's really cute. Okay, maybe not. So I wanted all those feelings in there.
The very last line in the book, the acknowledgments, Nathan Rosenberg. Nate, it's an absolute privilege to call you my family. Maybe the best thing I've ever done was click send.
I did click send.
Yeah, that's your husband, right?
That's my husband, yes. I did click send on an OK Cupid.
You did?
Yeah. I think
And it worked.
And it worked, yes. Yeah, he's wonderful and a great reader and supporter and fantastic. So I'm glad I clicked send.
And how did you end up in Philadelphia?
I came to Philadelphia in 2005 to see Beyonce, which was very exciting.
Truly.
Yes. But I loved the city. And I knew I wanted to base the novel here. And so my husband bought me a few trips out here for Hanukkah to say, go do your research. And I just really fell in love with it. And then he came back with me and we fell in love with it together. And so now it's home. Yeah.
And you are working on whatever this turns into, right?
Yes, I'll be executive producing, which is really exciting. And I think we'll have more clarity about where it will be in the next few months as soon as we, you know, come down from the high of publication. Yeah.
But it's been bought by a pretty well-known production company.
Yeah, it's really exciting. Lena Waithe's company, Hillman Grad, and Sight Unseen, who's also amazing. This is their first joint project, and I feel so grateful and challenged and protected by both of them. It's a really like perfect situation.
I mean, it seems like things are working out for you.
So far, so good. Yeah. Keeping fingers crossed.
And is there a second novel in the works?
There's definitely a second novel. And as I was saying before, the fact that I get to have the time to really luxuriate it in it is wonderful. It makes me think it'll take maybe twice as long. But now that I have the time, I'm really excited to explore a lot of these themes in a very different setting. So, yeah.
You won't have to have a second job, right? To write a novel.
I mean, the fact that I don't have to, it's a huge game changer. I mean, it's writing. There are so many things. If you have a chronic illness or children or jobs, there's so many things. And so I've been very lucky in that way to be able to make this work without a second job. And I'm excited to see what my writing looks like on that.
And do you even know what you're writing, how that will go? I mean, whether you will be one of those people that writes every day for a certain amount of time.
I like writing
every day.
As a lucky
pen or something?
Oh, no. You know, it's so funny. I will write anywhere, subway, on my phone, anything. I like to, when I'm first starting something, I write for about 4 hours in the morning, which is sometimes just me staring into space too. But I try not to have phone, internet, anything. But then when I have a whole body of work like I did with this one, there were some 10-hour days towards the end.
Well, it's been a great pleasure and congratulations.
Thank you so
on
much.
The book. Kylie Reed's new novel just been published called Such a Fun Age. And she did work at the, I should say, go to the Iowa Writers Workshop. I'm losing my voice here. And was the recipient of the Truman Capote Fellowship, again, living in Philadelphia. And she'll be speaking at Uncle Bobby's Coffee and Books. That's 5445 Germantown Avenue in Philadelphia. And this is this coming up Monday at 7 p.m. We're going to take a very short break, and then we've got Martha Graham Cracker waiting in the wings talking about a debut album that has just come out. It's an album of original songs called Lashed But Not Leashed. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. I'm Marty Mott.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Go in and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Martha Graham Cracker, Philadelphia's much-loved 6-foot-2-inch hirsute drag queen, has just released a new album of original songs, Lashed But Not Leashed. Here's one of the songs from the album. It's called Comfort of a Book.
I'll build a cocoon out of wood, pulp, and vodka. Just me and Franz Kafka. Safe inside my favorite easy chair. In the comfort of a book, I'll make myself a little nook. Trying to take a look. You can't see me with a book. A book doesn't talk back. Put on a little baccarat. I'll never fall in love again. In love again. Don't you worry about me, cause I'll be fine, 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 fine. You can leave me alone and I'll be fine, fine, fine. I feel myself getting better.
Our guest Dito Van Rygersburg created Martha Graham Cracker more than a dozen years ago, performing cabaret regularly in Philadelphia, New York, and other cities, including a stint in Las Vegas. I saw Martha Graham Cracker perform last year at Fringe Arts in Philadelphia, singing covers and mixing it up with the audience. It was great entertainment. We're going to play some more excerpts from the album and talk about doing drag Martha Graham Cracker style and Dito's relationship with his alter ego. He's one of the co-founding artistic directors directors of Pig Iron Theater Company here in Philadelphia, and still acts himself. And Dito, it's nice to have you back with us on
Radio Times. Thank you for having me.
So this is an album not of covers, but of original songs.
Yes. I sort of stumbled into this project in a way. The Kimmel Center has a sort of retreat for various cabaret or musical acts. They band together with a place called Joe's Pub in New York City, part of the Public Theater, and they have various cabaret groups come and just have an intensive songwriting session or creative session, making some sort of cabaret or music-based theater work. And we started out, and all I knew is that I wanted to join forces with people I knew were great songwriters. And so I called up my friend Eliza Hardy Jones and my friend Dave Sweeney and my friend Vince Federici. And I was like, you guys are great songwriters.
Yeah.
Would you sit in a tiny, tiny practice room with just a piano and Vince bring your guitar and let's just make some songs? And originally I wasn't even sure if these were going to be songs for Dito or were they going to be songs for Martha, because Martha is usually a cover girl. She usually covers songs or makes unusual versions of songs that you would recognize. She makes them sound a little different. But this was really I've written a few songs for Pig Iron in various projects that we've done, and I've always enjoyed – I'm a big nerd, and I enjoy like wordplay and lyrics and you know, I guess Stephen Sondheim is like a big crossword puzzler, and I really enjoy the puzzle of like, oh, this has to rhyme, but also has to be a satisfying use of wordplay, and I love stupid puns. And
well, they're all there.
They're all there.
Including some clever ones. But I have to say, even listening to some of the songs, I thought, uh-oh, is Martha Graham Cracker going to become a librarian? Is she going to go into
imagine?
A book and never leave? But I wonder, do you have a certain love for libraries, you yourself?
I do. I'm a great lover of books, a bibliophile, if you will. And I guess I've always been a person who is attracted to both an extroverted life and an introverted life. So I don't know. I passed your colleague Jennifer Lynn in the hallway.
Yes.
And we were talking about Hedwig, which is a show I admire very much. And in the last song of Hedwig, which is called Midnight Radio, there's a line that goes, "Know that you're whole." And I've always been very moved by that line, "Know that you're whole," because I think a lot of people are very confused or mixed up or embarrassed by their contradictions, quote-unquote contradictions. And what I really enjoy is being like a loud drag queen who's very extroverted and also someone who likes to sit at home and read a book and recite poetry to the cat. So,
and you get to do both.
So, and I feel like it's really important to say like those are both part of me, and that's not a contradiction. That's actually the being the fullness of a person.
It's funny that you say that, because I also think we're living in this sort of non-binary world, even when it comes to language and sort of
gender.
Learning this new language about sex and gender and identity and all the permutations that people can be.
Yeah.
And I mean, sometimes I screw up and sometimes I get confused and sometimes I don't understand. but I think it's very revealing and I think also very exciting.
Yeah. I think sometimes people ask me, what is the future of drag? And I don't know the answer, but what I do know is that drag used to sort of, because it was a more clandestine underground activity. There are obviously different versions of drag, but it was we sort of knew it as
risky and
we sort of knew it as one thing, and the more that it grows and becomes widespread as a phenomenon that everyone should be familiar with, even if you've only ever watched RuPaul's Drag Race, I think it starts to become more nuanced and our understanding of it becomes more nuanced. And there's like as many kinds of drag queens as there are birds that fly in the sky or, you know.
Do you worry that it becomes too, quote unquote, mainstream? I know you were in Las Vegas. I don't know all that you were doing there, but did that feel like?
No. Was I selling out? Perhaps. No, I don't. Do I worry about – I mean, of course, there's always the – I talk about this a lot with my friends in terms of the trade-off between what was joyous about something clandestine and underground, and then when it becomes more mainstream and when everyone knows RuPaul and everyone is sort of quoting drag queens in this way that you're like, I'm not sure that those words belong in your mouth. but go ahead. Fierce. There's a way in which you're like, oh, that's getting watered down. And there's this sort of trade-off, I think, too, between safety and a kind of
it's like rule breaking or just
there's with more acceptance there is this watering down, but there's also this, I think there's more safety, more inability to claim that you've never heard of such a thing, you've never heard that gay people and queer people are becoming much more visible. But also there's ways in which things about our culture gets misunderstood or appropriated or watered down.
Well, I do want to play one more song, but as you're talking, I'm thinking when I saw you at Fringe Arts, and it was clearly a very mixed crowd.
Yeah.
And your ability to sort of take down people's sort of uncomfortableness and sort of play with it, but also sort of make it feel more safe, even though it felt, I'm sure, for the people that you were going after, so to speak.
Terrifying. There's this
exactly.
Hairy drag queen sitting on my lap. No, I think one of my favorite things to do is to interact with the audience, but I really try to make it something warm and something – and I'm definitely good at reading. Like, this person clearly is saying no with their eyes, and I will leave them alone. But I do think there's – we spend so much time isolated, and it's so nice to have an interactive – theatrical experience.
I agree. Let me play another song, and this is from Martha Graham Cracker's new album. It's an album of originals. It's Lashed But Not Leashed, and this is a drag queen with a very large ... vocabulary.
I'm a drag queen with a very large vocabulary. You can use context clues to find out about that which I am talking.
Having fun listening to that song. And again, talking with our guest, Dito Van Reigersberg, created Martha Graham Cracker about a dozen years ago, more than a dozen years ago, and performs a cabaret regularly here in Philadelphia and other cities as well. And this is a new album, Lashed But Not Leashed. Do you still get the same thrill, excitement, dressing up as Martha Graham Cracker as you did?
I do. It feels different. It feels... I think at the beginning, it felt, and the beginning was, I guess in the early aughts, it felt riskier to me. It felt much more like I was scared. I was nervous. Speaking of safety, I was like, sure. Is this safe? Am I going to, is there, yeah, anyway.
Especially going out in public, I would think.
Yeah. It's sort of a risk to do this, to do drag, I think. And then once you get more used to it, you're like, oh, this is normal. And then it becomes sort of... about what ways do I want to take this character? How do I want to develop? And I developed her over. I had a very lucky thing happen, which is that when I my friends who run Latage, that's on 6th and Bainbridge, this cabaret space, they said, "Would you like a monthly slot?"
Oh, wow! And just like that.
I mean, I guess they'd seen the character before, and I said, I'm scared, but yes. And I think I really was able to build the muscle of the character and become more, it became a character that could easily slip into as opposed to something I had to think a lot about.
Right.
But it was scary at first, and now it's much more comfortable. And now I think it's about like what are the new angles? What are the unexplored corners of Martha? I mean, I've been able to make this original album of original songs. I've been able to perform with a string quartet, a brass band, like a choir. I mean, I've gotten to do a lot of my dreams. I've gotten to realize a lot of dreams musically with this character.
And I read that you did study at Martha Graham Dance Studio. Was that sort of the genesis or?
Well, it's so funny because I think, I heard a lot of stories about Martha Graham herself, who had died right before I started studying dance there. But all the stories were about sort of what a lonely genius she was and how she was a little bit like Norma Desmond figure who's sort of isolated and alone and speaks in iambic pentameter, but is sort of not entirely of this world, but made this technique. She's a brilliant person, but sort of lonely. And so I think I always thought, oh, she'd be that's a perfect name. And again, of course, Lashed But Not Leashed, I love.
That's a great title, by the way.
I love silly puns. And so Martha Graham, Graham Cracker, I was like, oh, that'll be my name if I ever become a drag queen. And then in the 90s, when I was studying acting in New York City, I would go and see drag queens perform at night. And I was like, maybe this is something I'd like to do.
Is Martha more famous, though, than you, Guido?
Isn't that terrible? I think she is.
I feel terrible asking that question.
But. Actually, one time I did have someone describe Martha Graham Cracker to me. I was in my civilian clothes, and I was like, oh, that sounds so interesting. They were like, yeah, there's this hairy drag queen that comes out, and she sings songs, but they're kind of original, or they're like covers of songs that you don't quite recognize at first, and she's very sassy, but she's also kind of sweet and kind of clumsy and a mess. And I was like, oh, that sounds great. I should go see that.
That's great. Have you done Drag Queen Story Hour?
These are
drag queens that are reading at libraries for kids?
Yes. That's definitely a bridge between my nerdy side and my drag queen side. I have done drag. I want to do it more. But I've read a lot of Dr. Seuss. I've sung some Dr. Seuss. The band would just start playing like a blues riff, and I was like, I'm going to sing "Sam I Am," but as a song, as a blues. I really thought that really bridges my interests. Yeah, and it's so ridiculous, of course, that it's been a controversial thing to have drag queens and children interact. But, you know, we live in a ridiculous world.
So what's Dido up to?
So Dido's
excited. Who's sitting across from me?
Sitting across from you right now. I'm still working with Pig Iron. So I perform with Pig Iron. I teach with Pig Iron. And then I'm still touring as Martha. I'm
And Martha's not going away. Right?
Martha's not. No, there is a a plot point in the performance that we do, the kind of play that we do of Lashed But Not Leashed, where I announce that I'm leaving show business. But that is actually just a plot point to get everyone scared and to think that they're seeing the last show, the farewell.
Well, originally I thought, oh, we'll have Dido's last performance on Radio Time or Martha's.
No, it won't be. It's just it's a way of starting the show in a kind of deep nostalgia place and in a place of regret, and then moving on to a place where I could be both a librarian and a drag queen.
Well, what a perfect combination. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank
on Radio
Time. Thank you
very
much.
You're very welcome. Dido Van Reigersberg, and again created Martha Graham Cracker more than a dozen years ago, and has a new album, Lashed But Not Leashed. And Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen produced the show. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. This is I'm Not Trying to Stop the Rain.
I'm not trying to stop the rain, baby. I'm just trying to dance when it hits the ground. I'm not trying to stop the rain, baby. I'm just trying to sing when I hear the sound. Long time ago, I fell in love with you. I chased that love as fast as I could.